Welcome to this 19-part series of Business Podcasts by David Maister, exploring the key principles and practices found in his new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this series of podcasts, I'm proud to present a special 19-part series of the audiobook version of my new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in purchasing a copy of the book in hardback, it is now available from both Amazon.com and at my website at davidmaister.com/store. Episode 6. Do you really want relationships? With this episode, we move from the 5 chapters on strategy to explore the topic of client relationships. The fat smoker syndrome that we know what to do, but find it hard to be patient enough to do the things that will lead us to our goals, finds no better illustration than in the area of client relations. One of the most common and ambiguous terms in business today is client centricity or client focus. Many businesses claim to have it, but if the essence of a relationship is a willingness to earn and deserve what you want by first focusing on the other party in the relationships, few companies really are client-centric. Many firms' so-called client relationship plans are not really plans to build a relationship at all. They are sales plans, which is not the same thing. A sales plan is a set of activities designed to generate revenues in the short run. A relationship plan is a set of activities to give, doing things that will build an asset, the relationship, that will continue to generate revenues into the future. Charles Green, author of Trust-Based Selling, has a wonderful analogy. He points out that many companies have the client focus of a vulture. They pay close attention to what the clients are up to, but only in order to figure out the right time to pounce. They are focused on the benefits they can get from the relationship, not on how they can provide greater benefits to the client. Like all aspects of the fat smoker syndrome, people are constantly looking for the magic pill that will bring them the benefits of a long-range program without having to do the work. In The Trusted Advisor, my co-authors and I pointed out that building trusted relationships with clients leads to many benefits. Less fee resistance, more future work, more referrals to new clients, and more effective and harmonious work relationships with clients. However, many people have built their past success on having a transactional view of their clients, not a relationship one. And it's not clear that they really want to change. Stated bluntly, people may say that they want the benefits of romance, yet they still act in ways that suggest that they're really interested in a one-night stand. As with all aspects of the fat smoker syndrome, the desire for instant gratification can prevent us from doing what is best for us in the long run. In romance, both sides work at building a mutually supportive, mutually beneficial relationship. They work hard to create a sense of togetherness, a feeling of us. Each side tries to truly listen to what the other is saying and feeling. The emphasis in discussions is less on the immediate topic at hand and more about preserving the emotional bond and the mutual commitment. Rather than seeking immediate short-term gratification and reward, romance relies on making investments in the relationship in order to obtain long-term future benefits. This romantic scenario is seemingly attractive, but when you look at the way most professionals deal with their clients, and how many clients deal with their professional providers, there's very little of it to be found. Most professional-to-client interactions involve little, if any, commitment to each other beyond the current deal. The prevailing principle on both sides is buyer beware. Mutual guardedness and suspicion exist, and the interaction is full of negotiation, bargaining, and adversarial activities. Both sides focus on the terms, the conditions, and the costs of temporary contact. It's us versus them throughout the encounter. This is the way many professionals and their clients want it to be. They want a transaction and may not yet, if ever, be ready for a bond. Rather than acting to build relationships, both sides might initially have the brakes on. After all, relationships require making a commitment and incurring obligations. They also mean focusing and being selective. You can't chase after every opportunity if you want to build relationships. To be good at relationships, you must have patience and know how to trust others. Moving from a one-night stand or transactional mentality to a romance or relationship mindset does not depend upon incremental actions, but requires a complete reversal of attitudes and behaviors. One approach is not necessarily better than the other, but there is a real choice to be made. Although it is not an identical comparison, the difference between transactions and relationships is similar to the distinction between being an expert to one's clients and being an advisor. An expert's job is to be right, to solve the client's problems through the application of technical and professional skill. In order to do this, the expert takes responsibility for the work away from the client and acts as if he or she is in charge until the project is done. The advisor behaves differently. Rather than being in the right, the advisor's job is to be helpful and to provide guidance, input, and counseling to the client's own thought and decision-making processes. The client retains control and responsibilities at all times. The advisor's role is subordinate to this, not that of being a prime mover. Viewed this way, it's easy to see why many professionals, while they may pretend to the virtues of being an advisor, actually do not want to be one. They do not want to advise. They want to take charge. For example, the asset manager does not merely want to recommend investments to the clients. He or she wants to control the client's funds. The trial litigator, similarly, does not want to provide input on trial strategy. He or she wants the client to cede authority to the warrior to do battle as he or she sees fit. Now, there's nothing wrong with either role. There are many times when the client is best served by selecting the true expert and putting his or her affairs in their hands. On other occasions, they may truly want and need an advisor. The only mistake on either side is to pretend. A practitioner who's wedded to expert ways, leave this to me, I'll get you the result you want, has every right to practice that way, but he or she has no right to complain if some or many clients prefer a different approach. Of course, it would be foolish for someone who really prefers being an expert to pretend that he or she is an advisor. The mentality is different. The personality required is different. The skills required are different. The work experience and the fulfillments are different. An expert who wants to be an expert is going to be miserably poor at pretending to be an advisor and is going to resent the client through the entire project, which apparently happens a lot. The issue of choosing between transactional and relationship approaches exists not only in dealing with clients, but also in dealings with people inside a firm. When I conduct seminars and workshops on managerial topics, those who pose questions often want to know how to get other people, partners, subordinates, employees, to change their behavior. The questions they ask nearly always suggest a transactional viewpoint, with the implication that we are just fine, they need to change. When I suggest solutions based upon building relationships with these other people, my questioners are often frustrated. Are you saying, they ask me, that I need to show an interest in my subordinates as people and care about their career ambitions? Only if you want them to respond to you, I reply. If your subordinates feel that you are prepared to work in a relationship with them, ensuring that both sides benefit, then they will give you more of what you want. That's human nature, not a political or religious point. But if they think that you, their superior, are just trying to get out of the deal more of what you want from them, harder work, more billable hours, whatever, then they will respond in kind. They will view you as you are viewing them, useful only to the extent that they can get out of it what they want in the short run. There will be no long-term loyalty and no commitment to the larger interests of the organization, because you have set the pattern that this is truly a temporary transaction, not a relationship. If you treat people as objects, tools, or as others, they in turn will treat you instrumentally. It's completely predictable and unavoidable. This analysis is not always received well. Managers are always trying to get more from that amorphous group of them, the subordinates, without having to build personal relationships. The reasons are often the same as in client situations. Developing relationships means creating commitments and obligations that people often do not want to incur. In spite of what they say their goals are, many individuals are just not prepared to do what relationships require in any context. Their resistance reveals not only their attitudes towards clients, but they're also their attitudes towards people in general. It is their attitudes that must change, not just their daily habits. Now, we must be wary of romanticizing romance or the advisory role. Relationships are not the best answer for all people at all times. There are also benefits to both parties in transactions. Relationships can be scary, particularly if the parties rush too quickly into creating obligations that neither side is yet ready to accept. Both client and provider may be reluctant to commit until they've developed significant experience with each other. Growing relationships is very personal and intimate. You actually have to be interested in others, listen to what they say and care about, and pay attention to their moods and needs. Few of these skills are required in a transaction. Where they are required, they're only needed for a short period of time, usually during the initial seduction, negotiating the deal, or when people play games pretending to care about each other. After that, the transactional approach, focus on getting the job done, not on the other person, allows you to remain detached and unengaged, which is actually very attractive to some people. You can emphasize the technical skills for which you were trained and not be stressed by the need for interpersonal, psychological, emotional, or political nuances. For many people, this is a great blessing. Relationships, by their very nature, are not as clear-cut as the negotiated contract terms of a transaction. On both commercial and psychological grounds, it's actually easier to see why some individuals may prefer the clarity and short-term gratification of a propose, get hired, deliver, get paid transaction. Transaction skills are very scalable. Expertise in winning and delivering transactions can be codified and disseminated quickly across an organization. It's less clear that the interpersonal skill of relationship building can be developed as quickly in a business that wants to grow rapidly. Transactions are also very appealing to those who find comfort in the rational, the logical, or the analytical approach, a description that includes many people who chose professional and technical careers. Little in professional training prepares you for the psychological complexities of dealing with or liking clients. The following comparisons show some of the differences between transactions and relationships. In a transaction or one-night stand, you focus on them. In a relationship or romance, you worry about us. In a transaction, you are basically opponents. In a relationship, you'll try to be on the same side. In a transaction, you focus on short-term benefits. In relationship, you focus on long-term benefits. Transactions are noted for the mutual suspicion. Relationships are built upon mutual trust. In a transaction, the goal is to make yourself look attractive. In a relationship, the goal is to understand the other party. In a transaction, the main goal is to negotiate and bargain. In a relationship, the goal is to give and be helpful. In a transaction, you try to preserve your options and avoid obligations. In a relationship, you make commitments. In a transaction, you focus on the present. In a relationship, you focus on the future. In a transaction, you develop a detailed contract. In a relationship, you have to be comfortable with ambiguous understandings about future reciprocity. In a transaction, your main goal is to prevail. In relationships, your main goal is to preserve the relationship. In a transaction, your style can be impersonal or detached. In a relationship, your style must be personal, engaged, intimate. In a transaction, there is preparation and rehearsal of what you're going to say and do. In a relationship, you need adaptability and flexibility to the responses of the other party. In a transaction, you listen to what they're saying. In a relationship, you listen to what they're feeling and why they're saying it. In a transaction, the usual feeling during the interaction is tense and enervated. In a relationship, the usual feeling is relaxed and comfortable. In a transaction, your interactive style is defensive and protective. In a relationship, the interactive style is open and inquisitive. Because I believe that the principles in my new book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, are the key to successful strategy execution in any organization, I will send a free copy of the hardcover book to someone in your management who you think should read it. and I will send you a special pre-release of the Executive Summary ebook free of charge. Details can be found at davidmaester.com/management. Additional differences exist between the two approaches. In pursuing a transaction or one-night stand, a small degree of exaggeration, misrepresentation, and manufactured appearance is normal and even expected. People rarely lie, but they rarely tell the whole truth either. For example, clients hide their project's true objectives and budgets for fear of giving too much away and being at a disadvantage in the negotiation. Or providers try to create the appearance of greater experience, competence, and capabilities than they truly have. A trusting relationship, however, requires complete integrity. Telling your spouse even a small lie will destroy years of relationship building. Switching from a transactional to a relationship approach in business requires a revolution of attitudes and behaviors. Gradual change will not take hold because everything people have learned through their success in transactions may work against them in learning how to be good at relationships. The most successful Don Juans and Donna Juanitas are unlikely to make the best spouses. What percentage of clients seek relationship advisors rather than transactional experts? What percentages of providers would rather be relationship advisors than transactional experts? I don't have hard data on this point, but I regularly poll my seminar audiences about what they look for when they are trying to buy professional services. Fully 80% of the typical audience reports that they would prefer to hire an advisor, and if they could find someone skilled in taking that approach, would be willing to pay a premium for it. 20% would not, preferring to seek out either the best technical expert or the low-cost provider. When I ask the same audience which approach they and their firms are currently taking, the interesting thing is that the numbers are frequently reversed. 80% report that they mostly market themselves as experts, or at least are currently perceived as such, although many have dreams or firm strategies of changing this to becoming trusted advisors. Now, these results are not, of course, scientific, but the difference between what people say when they are buyers and what they say when they are providers is striking. Although viewing dealings with clients or employees as a transaction is common and normal, and may indeed be the most common form of interaction, there is a danger that continuing to view clients or employees as them can degenerate into perceiving the client or the employees as the enemy. This can breed reactions that spiral into self-defeating behavior for both parties involved. All too often, the client becomes a competitor for things the professional wants, money, challenge, or control, not a partner in obtaining them. All this can lead to behavior that worsens the situation. Professionals act in ways that are pompous, patronizing, condescending, and arrogant, and the clients react to them by being, in turn, defensive, more guarded, and even less relational. Things begin to spiral downwards. As Charles Green points out in his book, Trust-Based Selling, you can tell that a professional provider is treating the client as the enemy when he or she prefers to work back at the office rather than at the client's location. Each side, jealous and insecure about its control, competes for power over the agenda or the outcome of a meeting or a phone call. Unlike healthy relationships, which expose and deal with problematic issues early, transaction players develop an inability to confront the other side on difficult issues. As a result of all of this, when client and provider become opponents, exaggeration, misrepresentation, selective disclosure of key information, and careful management of appearances become common on both sides. Both sides fight to be right and to prevail, rather than to collaborate on finding a solution. This impasse thwarts the best interests of all parties concerned. By treating providers with suspicion, buyers create an atmosphere that makes providers more reluctant to show a sincere interest in any client need or requirement beyond the terms of the contract. In turn, this unresponsive behavior reinforces the buyer's perception that providers are not worthy of trust and must be kept at arm's length, watched like a hawk in case they take advantage of the client. Like some ancient rivalry or bad marriage, the origins of the dispute are lost in the mists of time. It's impossible to discover who was first responsible for treating the other badly. All that can be observed now is a set of resentments and accusations of being treated poorly by the other side. Each side can point to specific behaviors that show they, the other side, are unfair, unreasonable, and untrustworthy. Each side has concrete evidence of behavior by them that proves we are justified in our thinking poorly about them. As a result, clients become more demanding and controlling in their buying behavior, and providers become more insincere and less responsive in their dealings with clients. Both sides end up actively encouraging the adverse reactions from them that they're trying to avoid. Other examples of dysfunctional client as enemy behaviors include rehearsing what you are going to say to the client in proposals and presentations rather than how you plan to get a true conversation going. Avoiding conversations with clients because you want either to remain in control or avoid having to treat the client as a person. Avoiding contact with clients unless there is something concrete to talk about. Trying to sell more work to get what you want rather than what the client wants. Requiring that all agreements and decisions be documented and formally approved rather than trusting each other's word. The most important agenda for most professionals is to ensure that they do not allow their transaction business to spin out of control into client as enemy behavior. Among all the outcomes, this is the worst, with no winners. Transactions are inevitable. Clients increasingly treat professionals as vendors. They audit bills, use purchasing departments and consultants in their selection processes, bargain hard, and emphasize contractual terms. Once this has begun to happen, it's clear that the client organization has categorized you as the evil other. What will follow with immensely high probability is going to be a transaction. But a transaction is not necessarily a tragedy. As long as enmity doesn't build up, this approach can achieve great success. Once you're working with the client on the transaction, you then have the opportunity to take advantage of the client contact to build a relationship for next time. However, firms must be vigilant in identifying where they are engaging in client as enemy activities and discuss ways to eliminate them. In addition, they must identify and eliminate anything they may be doing that causes the clients to view the firm as the enemy. As Patrick McKenna, my co-author on First Among Equals, observes, the first tangible acknowledgement that many clients get from their professional service provider is a standard retainer agreement that lays out in no uncertain terms what we're going to do for you and to you if you don't pay our bill in a timely fashion. How's that for a terrible way to start, Patrick asks. Why not make sure that the firm's first communication with the client is a letter of thanks for having been chosen, providing a note of reassurance to the client that he or she has chosen someone with some human sensitivity? If relationships are not always possible, the very least a firm can do is to ensure that it handles its transactions professionally and does not play the transaction game in such a way as to alienate the very clients it seeks to win and serve. Many people believe that individuals, by the time they reach positions of influence in their careers, cannot readily change. They also believe that if firms want to build relationships, they must recruit, develop, and retain people who have a predisposition for romance. They do not try to change transactional people in the middle of their careers. There's a great deal of truth to this observation. In Managing the Professional Service Firm, I wrote about two types of firms: hunters, based upon opportunistic individualism, and farmers, based upon collaborative teamwork. Many firms have tried to make the transition from the former to the latter, only to discover that it is extremely difficult to turn individualists into team players. The few institutions that have succeeded in this transition have done so not by changing people, but by replacing them. Firms begin to change only when the collaborative team players achieve positions of power and could insist on their approach. Another approach to making changes of this kind is to complement old-style players with people who do have the new attitudes and skills. For example, firms pair technical experts with client-friendly salespeople, encouraging them to meld skills and work together to win and serve clients. The real challenge, however, is for all of us as individuals, not as firms. Transactions are common because they involve less hard work and demand fewer skills. They are yet another example of the fat smoker syndrome. Doing what is better for us in the long run is the less frequently chosen path. We would rather do what gets us through today than invest in our future. Ultimately, however, mutual trust will allow both sides to get more of what they need. Relationships are not more noble than transactions, but where they can be created, they are much more profitable. Many professionals will want to make the terrifying and difficult transition from skilled seducers to relationship-minded collaborators. Clients can be successfully led into a mutually supportive relationship and away from treating us with suspicion, but only if we throw away the bad habits of viewing them as them and throw ourselves wholeheartedly into developing the skills of relationships. The key first step is to recognize that romance and relationships work by earning and deserving what you want to get back from the other party. Whenever a trade-off occurs, the rules of romance require that, instead of acting defensively to protect your own interests, you put the client's interests first and keep the faith that this relationship-building act will be repaid through future reciprocity. As the trusted advisor tried to show, this is not idealism since it leads to higher returns, but it does require an act of faith. Accordingly, the course of wisdom for newcomers to the approach is to be highly selective in choosing a first relationship to experiment with. As in all change efforts, a small-scale first experiment that has a high chance of yielding an early success is the wisest approach. Don't begin with your most important clients necessarily. If you're going to learn a new skill, it is better to do so in a situation where any initial fumbles will not be costly. If they are to capture market premiums, providers cannot in the long run afford to have clients continue to view them as the adversary. Providers need clients and employees to think of each encounter as an opportunity to build teamwork and a collaborative relationship. We must each decide whether, if we truly want the benefits of romance, we have the courage and patience to shake off old ways of viewing other people and become willing to learn new ways of dealing with them. This concludes this chapter of my book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. If you're interested in ordering a copy of the book in its printed form, visit Amazon.com or my website at davidmaester.com/store.